Welcome, everybody. This is the sixth interview in a series of nine this week as part of the Tate Encounters Research in Process programme. The title of this week's events are Education Practice at Tate Since 1970. And just to provide a little bit of context behind the reason for putting together this week's series of interviews with past and present members of Tate staff who have been involved in education at Tate, that one of the questions that the project Tate Encounters has been asking and looking at is how the museum has developed a relationship with its public and what the nature of that relationship has been. And historically, it is quite easy to argue that the education department has predominantly carried that relationship with the public in perhaps one of the more active forms of the museum. The second assumption, and with more increasing evidence as the project has gone on, is that as the museum has become of more interest in cultural politics and cultural policy and funding policy from government, that a lot of cultural policy initiatives have been mediated in the museum through the work of the education department. Another motivation behind putting this series together has also been the somewhat erratic nature of the documentation of the emergence of education practice in the museum. And while various records and documentation do exist in the archive of Tate, that history has been a little fragmented. And so in trying to put together this history through interviews with people over the last 30 to 40 years, try to create some form of, I wouldn't say narrative, but some alternative account than one presently exists. So without further ado, welcome to Andrew Brighton, who, well, I will leave him to say how he came to Tate, but maybe Andrew, we could begin with what were you doing, what did you do before you came to Tate, and how did you come here? When did you come here?
When, like, if you could ask me dates, I'll probably come a cropper. I think it was 92. I had earned my living by teaching in various institutions. I started first at Goldsmiths and West Surrey College of Art, and then I was teaching at Goldsmiths and Royal College of Art. In Goldsmiths, I was teaching both art history and art practice, so I was doing studio teaching and lecturing as well, and all the rest of the academic stuff. But studio teaching was part of my brief, and it was the idea that John Thompson promoted that art school, that theory and practice were not to be separated, and that he appointed a number of us who were both practitioners or interested in practice in a very upfront sort of way, people like John Tagg and Yehuda Safran, who came after, partly on my recommendation, to join the staff at Goldsmiths. So that was one of my first jobs. Then I taught in the painting department of the Royal College at the same time. These are all part-time jobs. And then I worked, as I said, I worked at Goldsmiths, and they had a research project. There was a discussion about what was the economic situation of visual artists, and the Gulbenkian Foundation decided to commission a report on this issue, and eventually they asked Richard Hoggart at Goldsmiths to run it, and he formed a research team of which I was one of the two senior research fellows with Nick Pearce, and so I spent about 3 years doing the research for this report. The report was something of a failure. I still bear the scars, and thinking about it is like digging up my own career grave. But it was very important for me, and I'd like to say something about why it was so important. I worked on looking at commercial galleries, and I interviewed about 50 commercial gallerists and had to produce an account of it and fit it within the general account of the political economy of the visual arts in this country, which we were producing. And I think that was an incredibly important experience for me and gave me a view of the art world which I still hold to and I think did me irreparable harm, in that it acknowledged the importance of commercial galleries as the prime source of financial support for artists making their own work. There was a kind, what was actually expected and wanted of that report, I think, was that it would make an argument for increasing state stipends and support for the Arts Council, etc., in order to financially support artists. And I went along with the one of the Treasury officials right at the beginning of the foundation of the Arts Council saying we cannot take on responsibility for the financial welfare of artists. It's simply too huge and difficult a proposition. And this, of course, I think has proved to be correct, and efforts to use state patronage in order to ensure the income of artists have proved pretty disastrous. But what it we provided the evidence to show is by a multiple of something like 12, the commercial galleries put money into artists' pockets to make money like nobody else. So that if you looked at the total expenditure on contemporary art of all the public institutions in this country, and then put it against the money put into artists' pockets by the commercial galleries, something, as I say, by a factor of 12, were the dominant contribution. However, one should qualify that saying that the people that put most money into art for the production of art are, of course, artists themselves working for little or nothing to produce the stuff. So the commercial galleries were second. Now, that, in a way, gave me a clarity of understanding about how the market worked, which also had a correlative. It told me about what the role of the public sector was, which I'd like to say a bit more about later. But that, I think, was a great insight. But after that, I had two children and a wife who was an illustrator artist to support. And so I went and got myself a full-time job at Oxford Polytechnic, as it then was, and taught art history there, nothing but art history. And then after that, I was running an MA in art and architecture in at Canterbury. Which was very useful, partly because I was working, I appointed two very able artists to work with me, Maria Lowndeska and, his name got out of my head, Mark Pibler, who were two very bright, sophisticated young artists, and I think that was an education for me. So it was in that context where we were teaching teaching art and architecture, and that sort of friction between the two, the irreconcilable differences between the two. So you could traumatize a fine artist by saying, I want you to make a drawing from which somebody else, when you're dead, could build a building or build something. Now, for an artist trained in self-expression, all that sort of thing, this was a trauma. And then to tell an architect that the idea of necessity and function was always ideological, was a trauma to them. So it was about disrupting the assumptions of both activities rather than finding some higher synthesis. But part of that job was also bringing in speakers and that sort of thing. Anyway, I applied for the job that Richard Humphreys got as head of education here at the Tate and got turned down. I remember the interview well. Nick Sorreta saying, what do you think you have to learn in the way of management? And I said, nothing. And I think my future was fixed by that. Anyway, Richard got the job, and then eventually Tim Marlowe was moving on to greater things, and he approached me to come and run the adult program, I think it was called then. And I was quite happy at Kent and didn't think twice about it. But anyway, I applied, sent my application in, which was then lost. I think maybe strategically by HR, because the head of HR was heard to say that Andrew Brighton was not a Tate sort of person. But anyway, I rang up Richard about 2 days before the interview saying, well, I haven't heard anything back. And he said, good God, I thought you hadn't applied. So anyway, they fitted me in. I came for the interview and dang my old boots, I got the job. And so that was the circumstance in which I came to be here, and that was my career background. I should add, however, that all throughout this time I had been writing art criticism largely for Studio International and then subsequently Art Monthly, working for Peter Townsend, who was editor there, and in various other magazines. I had been the London editor of a magazine called the New Art Examiner, which was, being an editor, I think was a useful experience coming here and running talks. And I had curated a couple of exhibitions, one in Nottingham in 1977, which had been an attempt to look at British art as at a cross-section. It was very much conducted, the whole argument was very much anti the Tate. The Tate at that time was modelling itself very much on the Museum of Modern Art in New York and tried to construct a kind of linear pattern of art development. It worked in terms of movements and succession of movements. And I tried to say this is wrong, that we should look across the board, and you could see that we're actually in a cultural war, and that the modernist tradition which the Tate was enshrining was only one part of what was being called art in this country. So we look in this exhibition at popular painting, the sort of painting that was popular in reproduction, and academic painting, the sort of painting that was being shown at the Royal Academy, and the kind of art that was excluded from the Tate. And this, always seeing art in those terms, has been another career-damaging insight which I still sadly hang on to, that we live in a cultural war, a conflict of values, which I think is not only a fact but also a very healthy fact about a pluralistic culture and people living diverse lives. So it was that idea of pluralism was one of the things that I certainly brought to the job here.
With this understanding of what the role of the private sector was in the production of art, what was your view of what the role of the museum was, or particularly Tate in that configuration?
Well, I think the importance of the public sector for me was not actually the amount of money put in, because clearly we discover that actually economically the public sector was not that important. What was important was that it was a source of dialogue. It made public the discussion about what constituted artistic value. And that was the primary role of the public sector. And in a way, I think that was very important to the flourishing of the art market in this country. And I remember Annie Judah telling me how important the creation of the Arts Council was for the growth of the commercial galleries. And so it is that idea of the public sector as providing the forum for public discourse, which seemed to me to be its primary role, and also the fundamental provide the fundamental rules of how you conduct yourself spending public money running a museum or an art gallery, that actually gives you certain sort of moralities or rules or ethics for your activity. And one of the ethics being that the plurality, the idea that you're actually creating a situation for arguments and discussion and not for celebration, uncertainties, or any of these sort of reifications that I think the museum tends to drift into. So it was about, in a way, spreading uncertainty rather than certainty, or feeding arguments rather than securing them. That was one of my primary interests and concerns, and one that I felt was actually a public good.
And what was the actual sort of brief for the job? Was there a brief, or did you make up your brief, or did somebody tell you what to do, or...?
It was very loose. Richard was a very good boss. He very much sort of said, this is it, get on with it, without being... what one had was conversations rather than being given a script. And he made it, I think, probably in discussions about whether I'd come or not, he made it clear that certainly I had a free hand within legality and morality, etc., etc. And so that was the attraction, that in a way... One way of putting the job was to bring the most intelligent people in the world to come and talk about modern and contemporary and art and British historic art, bring them to the Tate and make these things happen.
And can you say a little bit about what kind of programmes you ran? What sort of formats or genres? Or
I tried to experiment. There is, in a way, I suppose if I had been wise, I might have looked through my past programmes and been able to answer that sort of some sort of historical view. But I think it's better if I look back and say it would seem to me that there's two obvious things you can do in this area. The easiest thing is to simply be a venue where academics come and teach and come and talk, and you hold academic conferences on the one hand, and then you do popular lectures on the other, and there is little in between. Actually, it was the in-between that interested me. There is another genre, easy genre, which is the artist talk. But in a way, at the time, the artist talk was not that, I don't think it was as common as it has become. Certainly you got them in art schools, and you got this sort of, any artist of any note would be constantly being asked by art schools to come and do a gig, and they'd turn up and they'd do their thing. And certainly, I think, probably increased the number of artists coming to talk here, and then certainly increased the number of foreign artists from abroad that we had to come here. And that, of course, required an expansion of the budget, which I worked very hard at doing.
And did you work closely with the collection or the exhibitions program? What generated the content or the starting point?
That was the tradition I inherited, that you produced events which were tied into current exhibitions or major displays. And this was the largest source of disasters I think I had. Basically, it was to discover that curators, I think, for good and bad reasons, were very bad at saying who should come and talk about their exhibition. So you'd ask somebody, and you'd find that everybody that they wanted to come and talk about their exhibition was over 80, and some of whom were even dead. So it was a happy idea. But the primary thing was that my assumption was the point of having a discussion around an exhibition was not to, in a sense, amplify the arguments of the exhibition and its catalogue, but rather to bring them into doubt. So what I was looking for often was to find the people who were seriously critical of what that exhibition was about. And so you'd bring in the opposition and try to create a situation where the curator and the persons with whom had worked on the exhibition were brought into critical conflict with people who would take another view, who wished it done another way, and so actually expose the assumptions of those exhibitions to critical discussion.
And did you yourself play an active role? I mean, we've been hearing over the last couple of days' interviews, a lot of people's practice emerged out of giving lectures and a sort of personal one-to-one communication with the work of art, or even not a communion with the work of art. Did you promote that kind of experience?
Well, the notion
of an experience of the work of art, or what was your kind of paradigm?
One of the great things to do I'd done as a teacher, taking students around, say the MA students at Canterbury, we used to go every year to the German museums, and to walk into a gallery, stand in front of a work, often a very new work of art by an artist of whom we'd perhaps never heard, and simply standing there and trying to make sense of it. That was could be some of the most exciting teaching one ever did, because it wasn't teaching, it was, let's look, I don't know who the hell this person is, what can we make of the work of art? And collectively building some sort of understanding. And so I remember wonderful stumbling onto a Richard Prince retrospective in Rotterdam, and we had a whale of a time, and it was, to a certain extent, it was to do with the quality of the work. You discovered those works which sustained discussion were, which I take to be one of the characteristics of the fine art activity, because one of the businesses, for example, in relationship to the Gulbenkian inquiry, was how do you distinguish between art and craft? And so that had been something I put some thought of, and I would go to the view that artists are artifacts which are part of a discursive culture to an extent that is not the characteristic of craft. And of course, this is not necessarily fixed in the character, the material of the work. It's about the context in which it's put and the kind of capacity the work has to sustain, attract, and a serious discussion.
And the kind of discourse of art that you were carrying with you, did that correspond with the discourses of art within the museum itself, or did it share?
I think the Tate is, you know, there's many people work here, and there are many different views. I think there's a kind of way that if you're a curator, the high anxiety of putting work on a gallery wall in a professional and defensible way is one that, you know, confines your paradigm. And that wasn't my paradigm, and it wasn't my experience. I was working beyond that. So that while there had been shown, for example, of Hans Hacker and other people interested in institutional critique, in a way, I was carrying the tradition of institutional critique, which in which I had cut my teeth as an art school teacher and an artist, into the program in a way which I think hadn't been done to the same extent before. And I suppose how would I characterize institutional critique? One, it looks at the very context in which you are practicing and asks questions about it. I had always been particularly interested in the sociology and history of intellectuals as a strata, and tried to understand how they related as a strata to the practice of art. What was, and how, to the degree to which the values of modern art could be seen as ideological, that is to say, they were tied to the particular values of that strata. And so I'm very interested in the sociology of intellectuals, particularly as elaborated by Gramsci and then Goldman and various other American and French intellectual sociologists and this sort of thing.
And who was your ideal audience, or who was your audience you were developing these programs for? Who did you have in mind?
Well, I think this is a very important issue, because there's a kind of way which I think most museums and art galleries work with very bad sociology. They have a limited actual practical understanding of the people that come in, because it is impossible not to have a limited understanding of the people that come in. They are so plural. So what do? You tend to create categories of people. And you then say that they are they can that you've got to assume, for example, I think it was Simon Wilson said you've got to assume the level of reading ability of a Daily Mail reader. That's not an ideological classification, but a sort of a reading ability classification for writing labels. And I think there's a kind of way sometimes you have to make a priori discussions assumptions. Now I didn't want to do that, so I took an ideal type, to use I think Max Weber idea of who was the core audience that you were dealing with, and that to me was artists. Part of the function of a museum of modern contemporary art is to feed contemporary practice, and part of the discourse that it produces and makes public should be aimed at artists. And so for me, the core group which you were addressing, what were artists? Which isn't to say that every event was for artists, but in a sense, by making their discourse public and making them participants in it, you were giving yourself a core discourse which you then might popularise. But actually, in practice, somebody straight off the street knowing damn all about art could come to an event where you had artists talking about art, and they could intervene, they could bring to bear their particular knowledge of whatever it might be, religion or politics or how buses work or whatever it might be. But so in a sense, given that core, then it was open to attack or discussion or debate, but you had a sense of the community whose discourse you were trying to make public and who you were trying to attract in. And it would, for example, it would seem to me extremely difficult to do what I did or have the kind of program I wanted to do in a city where you didn't have something like 100,000 artists. In London, there are about 100,000, I mean, the figure can go up and down depending how you do your survey, but who call themselves artists. Well, if you can get 1% of them to come to your events every 6 months, then you've actually virtually filled your auditorium. So in a sense, in a great city such as London, then what you can do is very different from what you could do in Manchester or Birmingham, and maybe you could only do something similar in somewhere like Edinburgh or Glasgow.
So did that lead you to forge any particular partnerships or to look to art schools? I asked that in the context that other people interviewed, and Sylvia, on the whole, the reference points for say, adult or public programmes, as it was called, was more the higher education, was sort of the Birkbeck, or there were courses. Was this audience of artists coming anyway, or were you developing that?
Well, in a number of ways. One is simply who are the artists one admires, who thinks a hot property, who would come in and talk and you would, you know, you'd send an email to Hans Richter or whatever, and try and get great figures in from abroad, important artists who basically you chose because you admired their work, and they often would not be in the gallery's collection or have been exhibited by the gallery. Most of them subsequently might well be, but one was ahead of their game because, in a sense, the commitment was far less. And here, can I just make because I'll get it out of the way. One of the things I think I am proud of here, which is something that Sylvia and I did, was we increased the income of the department many times, 10 times. And we did this by Sylvia running courses, which brought in income, and also by charging. So I was very Thatcherite in that I said that free events, I was against free events in the evening programme, certainly, on the basis that A, undercut those places like the ICA, which have to make money in order to survive from gate, but also to increase our income within the institution, which then allowed us to argue for more staff. And when they started talking about cutting it, one could say, well, yeah, you can cut a member of staff, but I tell you, you'll save yourself £25,000 a year by cutting that member of staff, but you'll lose £30,000 a year because that person is necessary for us to keep at the level of programming. So we built income. We built income that way. The other one was by getting into bed with various people. And you mentioned higher educational institutions, and that I did a whole lot of institutional liaisons with art schools and universities, and that's one way. And so it's always a negotiation about their particular agendas and that sort of thing. But the other thing, I also hobnob with gallerists, so that when an artist, say Tracy Moffat, was showing at Victoria Miro, Victoria was very helpful about saying, well, could she come and talk at the Tate? She'd say, I'll ask her, and then she did. And she did a number, and this was somebody that would cost us, say, £1,000 to bring over from New York, but we got her for relatively little, gave her a good dinner afterwards, and everybody felt very happy about it. So it was playing the game. It was, in that sense, it was. But I remember one year, I think we had a budget of about sort of 60,000. But this is Tate Modern, where I think we had an income of about 350,000. From various bits and pieces, doing liaisons, doing deals. I love doing deals.
Pre that move to Tate Modern, though, I mean, Sylvia spoke very eloquently yesterday about sort of the Thatcherite period when the museum and the debates about value for money and income generation started to appear, but also talking about the kind of new culture of sort of celebration of art and artist entertainment and the more socialising. The emergence of a more socialising experience of the museum, and I think we can hold you responsible for introducing wine after events and other such practices. But that kind of extension into
I tried to introduce it before the event as well.
But what was in the sort of the ethos of trying to do that?
Well, that's about creating spaces where people stood together and talked. Because, you know, if you go to an academic conference, often the most important things that happen to you at an academic conference are discussions you have between the papers. And it was to make sure you got an audience in, and they had experience, and then they had time to discuss it afterwards, to exchange opinions, to meet each other, to, in a sense, I can't say the word without slipping into obscenity, because I can't say it, but I got my wife's teeth in tonight. But it was about getting people together. It's partly from this art and architecture experience. You realise that there's no way you could systematically get these two disciplines, no, well, not disciplines, practices, to meld together in any coherent way without it becoming ludicrously arbitrary and a rather dumb view of both activities. But what you could do is set up social situations where artists and architects met, and at certain points some things would click between them. And that's what you were doing. You were trying to create a framework where serendipitous events could take place, which might lead to other things. And so I thought of us in this great city as one of the places where these sort of connections, these sort of irregular meetings of minds could take place.
The kind of audience you're talking about that's quite a specialist audience, or even artists as practitioners, where did your programme sit within the kind of wider remit of what I think was then called interpretation and education, or maybe just education department? Did you work closely with other teams, or?
Not really. I have to say, I think I'm a bad institutional person. I have an idea what I want to do, and I do it. So, for example, I think it's a tribute to my bad behaviour at committee meetings that at the beginning of my time at the Tate, I sat on far more committees than I did at the end, because I think I was such an unpleasant or boring person to have on committees, because I was very defensive of what we were doing. And while I tried, in principle, to say one should work with other people, to a certain extent, I was fairly hard-nosed about seeing their impingements. And also, just as for the curator hanging work on a wall, there are your defences, there is the nightmare of the events organiser, which is introducing the speaker to an empty hall. And so somebody would say, we should have so-and-so. And I'd say, fine, they're important, I'd respect their work, etc., etc. But it won't fill the hall. And to a certain extent, that was almost, you'd say, if they'd fill the hall, let them in. But one of the great things one discovered is that, for example, I remember when we had Valdemar Jankacek and Melvin Bragg and Weaver from Imagination on the platform, and the hall was half empty. We had Mike McCarthy a couple of days later, packed out, turning them away. And because we built an audience for the kind of events we did. And one of my treasured memories is Saturn Radio 3 for being too middlebrow, which was we started doing a group of events with Radio 3 where we said, well, you come and we'll work together. Well, of course, that meant was the BBC took what they're doing in a studio and put it in Tate Modern. They advertised these events on not only Radio 3, but on Radio 4. Empty hall. Because they were always trying to do generalist artists, arts audience stuff. They didn't use the kind of speakers we wanted. They had their sort of media, their kind of people. And it just did not work for our thing. So after about three or four of these, I said to them, and they would say, well, what's the next one? I said, we're not having the next one. You're off. We've tried to get you to work with us. You haven't worked with us. Go away. And we had, there was quite a lot of shouting and screaming went on. we took them out, the two people, and we got them so pissed that they. But anyway, we were never forgiven for that one. But I think we did the right thing, and it's a criticism I would make of them then, whether they're any better at it now. Is they cannot change their paradigm, and I sense it's hypocrisy on my side because I'm not that good at changing my paradigm either. But we couldn't mesh it together, and so it would have, for me, had to be an event where we could have got. Which would have attracted our audience, and in a sense had the looseness and the right, for example, to be boring. It is very important that an artist or a group of people talking about art can be boring, because of course with Radio 3 they'd always want some media friendly MC person to jiv it along, make sure it got onto the right agenda, etc., etc. But we always allowed ourselves, of course, much more space, much more time, as I say, the right to be boring. So those are the... I'm not quite sure what the question was. I'm starting to ramble. This will happen, I'm afraid.
But when you said earlier you were quite defensive about the programme, and I'm just wondering what do you think the understanding within the museum of the purpose of your programme was?
Periodically, with less or greater force, when the next exhibition coming up, I would meet with the curator and we would try to work towards a programme. And sometimes I went all along the line with them, and they were often disastrous in one way or another. And often I felt that they almost are being set up for disaster. They weren't committed. They didn't have the fear of the empty hall, or they didn't have the fear of the incredibly boring event, And so it never worked. The most disastrous things I ever did was when I worked most closely with curators.
So what kind of skills and expertise would you have said were important? I mean, was this a profession or was this a practice? What is it you were...
I think what I did bring was the fact that I'd trained as an artist. I'd been to St. Martin's, I'd been a painter, and then the Royal Academy School, and then the Royal College. I spent an awful long time in art schools. And so the kind of people I was reaching out to were the kind of people I'd been at art school with and the kind of people that I had taught for the last 20 years. So I knew my audience. I knew their... I had, by that time, a kind of instinct for them. So that was, I think, one of my primary bits of cultural capital I could bring to the job.
And at this time, when you were still here, we'll move on to Tate Modern, but at this period, was there much interest or need to articulate who your audience was or monitor them? I mean, I asked this as yesterday Sylvia talked about a sort of earlier period when video cameras were acquired by the education department in order to film visitors to events, in order to provide that as evidence to DCMS. But
I wasn't part of that. That was not part of my experience. I'm very
was there any kind of audience?
Well, the thing is, because I put such emphasis on income, if you're producing income, you can tell people to go away. And so, you know, bums on seats was not what it was about, but bums on seat was the way you got yourself the freedom to do what you wanted to do. That if you made that the register of success, then you could get away with it.
And that kind of autonomy, did that continue throughout your practice at Tate? I mean, when you moved to Tate Modern, did...
Yes, I mean, periodically there were various assaults from various people wishing, A, that I worked closer with the curators, or that I was more integrated with the education element, this sort of thing, and those kind of pressures. But I saw them off to quite a large extent by being such an unpleasant human being.
Can you say something about the move to Tate Modern? What was your sense of the change in the institution and the change in your role? How did it happen?
Well, to a certain extent, I'd say that Tate Modern was a kind of, I hoped, was going to, well, to put it this way. The idea that art was no longer could not be and should not be described as a succession of styles and made chronological. I remember apparently at the beginning of the planning of Tate Modern, I think it was Sandy Nairn and Jeremy Lewis did a sort of a plan which would be in a chronological trot through the Tate Modern. And this was the first plan for the layout. And I had argued for a long time, and the exhibition I'd done in 1977 had argued against this chronological form of display. And there was, and to a certain extent, when the Tate decided to make it a thematic display, and so to deal with it, and so you had, in a sense, different elements, four different elements, which might historically be describing the same historical period, but in different ways, different emphasis. And the idea that you might hang according to the kinds of subjects that were being shown, which is what we did when in this Towards Another Picture exhibition 1977, where we clustered Richard Hamilton next to the painting of trains by David Shepherd, he of Charging Elephants fame, that there was a commonality of subject matter. These kind rehanging by these incredibly much more complicated factors. That happened at Tate Modern, so to a certain extent I felt I was coming home, that Tate Modern was closer to the museum as I would want it to have been in the way it was hung, and was more and the kind of things that I'd been doing at Tate in the talk program were the obvious place for this to happen. So I did apply for the head of education there and was again turned down. I can't remember what particular. Oh, faux pas. They said, who had influenced you? And I proceeded to say, who were your formative people? And I gave my list. And I was told afterwards I failed to mention a single woman. I talked about Kant and Hegel and Clement Greenberg and people like that, and I didn't mention a single woman, which was my mistake. There were women, writers, etc., who had been important to me, but that didn't come out at that particular moment. Less said the better. But it was when they appoint Toby Jackson, they will make a commitment to doing the kind of thing that the DCMS wanted them to do, and I was obviously not the person to handle that. I would have been a disaster as head of education in terms of making it.
What was the shift? I mean, in terms of DCMS, what were you aware? I mean, was this tangible or is this retrospective thinking?
Well, you had to show certain. What you had was basically, it was an old. It's quite a interesting historical evolution, whereby you could rehearse it in terms of the idea of community art. When I was in the 70s, the community artists were arguing that, from a left point of view, that the working class was, in a sense, the class in the process of becoming. It was good Marxist stuff. And so community art was, in a way, enabling and hastening history's horse by giving a graphic expression to the interests of working people by, setting up poster workshops and all this sort of thing in working class areas and working on political campaigns, etc., etc. So that was an argument. Also, you avoided the sins of the market and then bourgeoisement and all that sort of thing. By the time we get to the 90s, this has been turned on its head. Community art is a way of embourgeoisement. It's a way of solving social problems. It's supposed to stop people thieving cars. It's rather as if somebody had gone to Glyndebourne and looked around and said, I don't think anybody here is making a living by stealing car radios. Therefore, if everybody goes to opera, then everybody will stop stealing car radios. So there was this idea that art was good for you. Now, art, it seems to me, it's very important that art can be bad for you. Just think of the number of young men who have been misled by Baudelaire. I mean, there's that kind of thing. Now, I think Toby was very much sold on this outreach idea and was very much wanting to do that. To a certain extent, at times, I think he wished I would do some of that kind of thing, but he... I think he reconciled himself that I was not his man for that particular neck of the woods.
But what did this kind of shift mean to you as somebody interested in institutional critique in terms of the changes in the museum? I mean, were you completely untouched by what was happening? You were left, you didn't become part of the museum education project of Tate Modern, or?
I think what it was, we had a strong, and I was working once again with Sylvia, we had a strong package already, and it would either stay here or go to Tate Modern. The character of what I've been doing in terms of international program, etc., etc., made to a certain extent that if I'd stayed here and been limited to the extent that Tate Britain is limited to British artists working in this country, would have obviously have curtailed it would have been a diminution of what we'd been doing. So it was obvious that we should move to Tate Modern a certain extent. However, there was a long hiatus where it wasn't clear where I was going to be, and I was kind of left hanging by the Tate for 4 or 5 months where I didn't know where the hell I was or what was going to happen to me.
Can I just pick up on that? When you say, had you stayed here, but the international protected you from what, a reduced programme or a different type of narrative or a different type of debate?
I mean, if I'd stayed here, I would have tried to readdress the whole history of British art, which I think needs readdressing. I think the history of British art is a bloody more interesting than actually the Tate betrays it or the kind of scholarship that it attracts. It's a more complex history. Partly this is because the internationalism art history, meaning primarily the Americanism of art history, means that we have a map that we apply to this country. And also, if you just look at the sort of institutional critique tradition, people take Pierre Bourdieu and apply him to museums and galleries in this country, etc., totally ignoring the different sociological status position of art and culture in French culture or in European wider culture, and the different historical basis for intellectual culture and in this country, the different history of the bourgeoisie in this country, etc., etc. You have, in a way, you have to readdress, reconstruct the integrity and the dynamics and the strategy of the strategies and the cultural wars taking place in this country, which I still think are unresearched, undeveloped, unseen, are always vanished away by the professional requirement that if you are going to be an internationally published art historian, then to a certain extent you have to internationalise your account of your culture, if you're going to talk about your culture. But of course, the art historians who have done most well of my generation have largely gone to America.
In terms of sort of international and national, did the notion of Tate as a national institution play out in any way in your thinking of it? Did it mean anything?
I think
was there a difference between Tate Britain and Tate, or moving from Tate Gallery to Tate as a?
Because we were always thinking internationally. That wasn't a big change. It was like, as I said, we were going home. Because I didn't do a wonderful job on historic British, because it wasn't where my knowledge prior to, I suppose I've done quite some work on 19th century British art, the one or two conferences I involved with, which I think went quite well, but historic British was not my strong point, and probably the programme and the inadequacies of the programme that I ran in that area reflected that ignorance on my part.
I mean, during the time at which you were at Tate, you also were quite renowned for your own independent activity in various ways. I can't remember if this was the period in which you curated as well. The Serpentine Show?
That was just before the Serpentine Show.
But you had various guises and various interventions in cultural debates, which perhaps were at odds with the institution.
Well, I think it was rather good to take... There's an anecdote I tell which illustrates this. I produced, you've got it on your knee, I was a trustee at the Pier, which was an arts trust with Ingrid Svensson, who was an ex-student of mine, was running with great distinction and putting on exhibitions. They started with a Chris Marker show, which was terrific. Anyway, and I was very worked up about the policies of the Labour government. I said we ought to do something about it. And she had the idea that we should do an anthology, and she said it should be a beautiful book, and that's what's sitting on your knee. So it's largely Ingrid who thought about that. Well, one of the things we did was we took the speeches of Chris Smith and we edited with integrity. I mean, we were working with Mary Warnock and... Mark Wallinger on this, so they were the editors, but most of the editorial work was actually done by Ingrid and I, and so we had to get it past those two. But I edited down a Chris Smith speech, which I thought got most of his arguments in, and we then went for permission to publish it, and they didn't answer, and then they came back and said, no, you've got to publish this speech and all of it, by which time we were going to press. And we said we can't do that. It's too small. So we decided, we'll do what we said. It's the only way we can do it. So we had a space for Chris Smith. So we just simply shrunk it. So it was in terribly small type. It's still in there. In that time. Well, anyway, about three weeks before the book was published, I met one of his advisors, and I said to her, I'm sorry you haven't let us publish what we want to do. So we are publishing what you told us to do, but we're doing it in 3-point or whatever it is. And she went pale. It was wonderful. Anyway, about next day, I got rung up by the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, who'd rung Nick's office, and they got my telephone number, and there was Chris Smith pleading with me not to do this. And I said, well, look, you know, we're going to press. I'll have to talk to the editor. And I rang up Ingrid and told her what had happened, that Chris Smith had been on the telephone asking me not to do this. And she said, well, you know, it'll cost us money. I think, fuck them. So she rang up, she's a good, well-brought-up American girl, and she rang up Mary Warnock, who was Baroness Warnock, and said, what should we do here? And Mary Warnock, being a well-brought-up English girl, said, fuck them. So we went ahead, Mark Wallinger was out of the country at the time. So we went ahead and published it in this small site, but we did put in some other stuff by Chris Smith. But one thing that happened there, which I think was amazing, I never heard a word from the director's office about it. There was me, member of his staff. Chris Smith clearly knew that I was a member of Nick's staff, winding him up like nobody's business. And Nick never mentioned it to me.
Can you say something about what were the issues that you had with the policy at that time?
Don't start me. Let me think. I'd like to think about principles here. I'd like to think of principles. Let me go back to the idea that the public discussion, that the primary role of certainly visual art public patronage is to create public spaces where people can work and talk about works of art, where you publish serious texts about works of art, where in a sense there is, it's a bit like the Bank of England. It's a guarantor to a certain extent of the integrity of that discussion. Once you start to actually say that discussion has certain predictable and predicted outcomes, that there are certain moral and political presuppositions that have to be embedded in that discussion, then it's like the Bank of England putting lead into gold. It's a corruption of that public discourse. So for me, those policies were and are against the public interest, because it actually corrupts the public discourse. And I was particularly aware of this because I'd one time done research and taught a course on Soviet socialist realism, and I knew the literature of Soviet socialist realism. I knew the argument, and I published an article, actually with republishing that thing, comparing Soviet socialist realist theory with the utterances of Tony Blair and Chris Smith and the rest of them, which I published in Critical Quarterly to begin with, and demonstrating that the same logics were taking place. The same, it's, if you want to put it in, give it a sort of scholarly background, it's the distinction that Isaiah Berlin makes between positive and negative freedom. Berlin defends negative freedom, but says that positive freedom, the idea of freedom which has itself some sort of teleological base, it's a removal of freedom. And so the fundamental understandings of culture and how it, and using it as an instrument of social welfare, the logic which the Russian theorists developed, of course, because the principle was the same, had a lot in common with the utterances of our leaders.
Because this was quite a key moment. I mean, was there sympathy from your colleagues, or this was a moment of where people were asking questions about who is the museum for, why should the museum be publicly funded?
I think there was sympathy, but I think most people are less wound up by it than I am, partly because I think they probably don't have quite my sense, which might be misapprehension, of what it, the political ramifications of what it is when the state assumes that it can set the a priori assumptions and the destination of what culture is supposed to do. That it is that if you disallow that sort of autonomy to an area that you are funding, the implications right across the political spectrum are huge. That is, because in a certain extent you assume that your political your population is a victim whom you are doing good for, and there is nothing more dangerous than people doing good to others, demanding things not on their own behalf but on behalf of some abstract victim group of victims which they then proceed to take the supposed needs of that group in order to control that group. So here you have the idea that the great word at that time was the excluded, and the idea that the museums should reach out to the excluded. Now, if you look at the definitions of the excluded, you found that anybody could be included. If you've got one leg, you're one of the excluded. If you're a gypsy, you're excluded. And in a way, it was a part of this sort of community art switch around. It was the idea that those who were different were victims who needed to be brought into the fold. The fact that some people have different sets of values and that they live by those values, that those values make sense for their life, was not part of what they were saying, and which seemed to me to be a fundamental assumption of recognising the integrity of people's difference. So everybody's difference from the kind of regime of Tony Blair, etc., were in a sense people to be regarded as victims. And how do you disenable criticism? You say that it's coming out of your pathology. So it's a pathologizing of various groups in society. But also, if you just think of it, the idea that you take, Karen Matthews is, your archetypal member of the excluded, and to a certain extent, the idea that the Tate could do anything for Karen Matthews it was obviously ludicrous. I mean, I live on a council estate. I live with people and the woman I live next to is a single parent family. And she's a Catholic, and she brings up her kid, and she struggles on bugger all money. But the idea that somehow or other she needs to take gallery, I mean, piss off. This is patronising bollocks. She has probably as rich a metaphysical life as you or I without the damn Tate Gallery. So I thought it was immensely patronising. I thought it was politically, ultimately totalitarian. Because it in a sense, says the state has a total responsibility for everything in society, and in a sense should bring everybody into its notion of themselves.
But at any point,
I told you, once you press a button, I'm off.
But at any point, did you also think that the audience needed to change a little? Was there, or did you work with the notion of an audience at any point that changed from before you arrived to moment?
One was there's always the changing character of art and the changing of generations. There is to a certain extent we would ask ourselves the question: if you're a Sun reader and you walked into the Tate Modern and you were interested, was there somewhere you could go to acquire the information that you wanted? So I, for example, was for labels on walls, but they should provide tools for understanding works of art. That was what they were there for. They were not there to persuade you that these were great works of art, or that the artist was heroic, or that what they were doing was morally good or politically good, and this sort of thing. So one of the things I deprecate in the Tate now is an awful lot of their wall posters are not giving you basic factual information with which to work on the works of art. They're telling you, they're sort of massaging you into sort of sympathetic admiration for the work, which seems to me to be, once again, deeply patronising.
And did you contribute to those discussions about what interpretation was at Tate? Were these?
I did attend some committee meetings to which I was not subsequently re-invited. I think that's probably the case. Simon would probably remember some of that.
I mean, it's amusing to hear how you. Your strategic way of getting out of meetings, but at the same time...
I didn't plan... I thought I should have total power over the whole institution, but in a certain sense, I was willing to be up for these things. It wasn't strategic withdrawal. I think it was the Tate's strategic withdrawal.
Which contributes to my question. I mean, this was a period, having been here also at some of that time, of the rise of the meeting culture. But the purpose of those meetings and the people who came together in those meetings, I mean, the kind of organisational structure and the space that those meetings and the kind of discussions, why did you not try to influence them by your own account?
I think I was bad at it. I was too impatient. Invariably, I was wanting a cigarette, and always puts me after about 25 minutes in a meeting in a bad temper. So I think it was my fault. I can look at certain things that I failed to do because I was politically inept. I wasn't very good at, in a sense, being perhaps sufficiently respectful and understanding of other people's positions and where they're coming from. So I don't think I'm covered in glory by this failure to influence other things. I think it was partly my own personal aggression.
I suppose what I'm trying to get in terms of thinking about what Sylvia said and Tim Marlow was, where did you try to influence?
Well, let me give you an example. I argue that the Tate should be producing not only Tate magazine, but also a journal, which would be publishing papers, often those delivered here at conferences, because there's some terrific stuff coming through. And I did research, and I met with somebody who had experience of academic publishing. And what she said to me, which I took to this meeting, was, look, if you go to an academic publisher, they will wet themselves to take this on board. Because what people, most academics, don't realise is that people like Thames and Hudson and Blackwell's make sheds loads from academic publishing. It is extremely profitable form of publishing, because all you need is something like 300, 500 institutional subscribers throughout the world, and you have a solid economic base for that magazine. Most of them don't pay their contributors, and maybe there's a token salary for the editor or something like this. So this is very profitable. So I took this to a meeting at the chaired by Jeremy and with grandees from the Court Hall, etc., etc., and I explained this and saying, look, I've already approached one academic publisher of this, and they were really up for it. I mean, they kept on ringing back. They were really up for it, and it would have cost us nothing. The meeting just simply wouldn't believe me. They wouldn't believe that we could do it for nothing. They wouldn't believe that anything, and it disappeared. Now, I think if I'd been politically more apt, I could have gone on. But I just got angry and said, fuck it, I'm not going to, I'm busy enough. I've got enough anxieties with running this programme. I'm not going to push this any further. It's there for the taking, but if nobody's going to help me take it, then I'm not going to fight it. So I think that was a total failure on my part, and partly a failure of my own, an indicator of my own political ineptitude.
But the production of knowledge that was going on in the programmes that you thought was worth disseminating, trying to sort of think about, I mean, we now have a research department at Tate, but do you think that's really the work of a museum to produce? What was distinct? What was so distinct about the knowledge that you were producing there, well, for dissemination, that wasn't happening in, say, an art school postgraduate programme or a research programme or higher education, university?
Well, I think one of the things is that we had resources which other people didn't have. That if you are somebody who's asked to speak in public, when you're asked to go and give a talk for threepence halfpenny in Dundee, you're not that keen. But coming to the Tate, feels good. It's flattering. So there's that. We had more money to bring people over. We could hotel them. We could etc. For me, the point of the magazine was to actually, as a way of further attracting serious papers. It was a way of improving the actual spoken program, but not just as an end in itself. So if I try to get and understand your question better, Would you like to ask it again?
I suppose it's sort of what kind of scholarship or expertise or knowledge we're producing, or why not go into collaboration with the court, or in the same way that there were partnership programmes, why not have partnership publications elsewhere?
I think this is another of my... I have... I could give a historical route to this. If you look at the Coldstream report, in a way you could say Coldstream and that committee that set up art school education in the early 60s, that came to fruition in the early 60s, had this idea of something called general studies. And there was Pevsner cast doubt on it in the report, in a minority report, if I remember rightly. But what if you ask, what is the notion of the artist that's embedded in the Coldstream report? It is the artist as somebody who is an intellectual, but intellectually promiscuous. So there's this idea of general studies, and a lot of very peculiar people, you know, psychologists, anthropologists, physicists, whatever, started teaching in art schools at that time, writers, etc., etc. It was the idea of an open-ended intellectual culture. And I think that, for me, was what it was about. It was not going to be an academic journal. It was going to be a journal for serious, whatever seriousness might mean, which might actually mean doing something that's very funny, papers about art and the issues surrounding art. So it would not have been, it would have been a much more interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary publication, and that would have been reflecting the character of what I was doing, because this is in a way what followed from the idea of the artist as your paradigmatic member of the audience, is that you were feeding that promiscuity of intellectual ideas. So, for example, famously, Cézanne, according to Merleau-Ponty, carried a copy of Kant around with him. He didn't carry around the third critique, the aesthetic. He carried the critique of judgment. So, in other words, it was the philosophy per se, not the aesthetics, which interested Cézanne. And I think if you work in art school, you know, you find, in my time, that people would get into all sorts of things which were immensely diverse. And in a way, art history was perhaps the least interesting of those things people would get into, or least influential. People were reading poetry, people were reading novels. Somehow in English art schools, the tradition was reading things in translation. And people were much more likely to have read Hegel than they were to have read any of the contemporary British philosophers. They're more likely to have read Hegel than they would have Russell or something like that. So there was this European sort of promiscuity of interests, and that in a way that led to some conferences which were total failures, but some of the best ones were where actually something happened, where two disciplines, something magical happened between two disciplines, which were some of the best conferences. Because I'd have to say that one of the reoccurring experiences of anybody who runs events, certainly for me, was the constant disappointment. Nothing ever was, very few things were ever as good as you'd hoped they'd be. And also, to a certain extent, but on the other hand, you'd say, my God, that was terrible. And somebody would come up to you and say, that was absolutely wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. And if you moved around that drinking audience after a conference, you'd have people who are thrilled to bits and people who are absolutely saying this is garbage. You know, people who had said that was a wonderful paper and somebody else over there saying it was garbage. And you just, you know, the experience is not the same for everybody.
This championing of an intellectual culture within the museum and a sort of project of seriousness. Did you attract curatorial staff? Did Tate as an organisation engage?
The absence of curators from the major events that I organised was conspicuous. Very rarely did curators come to
the event. How would you account for that, or not?
I assume
was there a debate of aesthetics, do you think, going on, or a debate of...
The curators, I don't know. I don't know if this is relevant, but I did actually try to impinge on the curatorial programme by, they asked at some point for proposals. So I proposed an exhibition which, in the middle of one of the chambers here, one of the, I think, would be the Carl Andre's equivalents, And around it would be on the one side, in neat frames, the copies of the newspaper coverage, and on the other hand, the internal documentation of the tape. And so you'd have all this discourse around the edges of the room, but in the middle would be the minimal, silent, I think, commanding beauty of those bloody bricks. And I got brought up in front of the curators with Jeremy Lewison, as sort of, it was literally, there's a table with all the curators down either side and Jeremy in the middle. And I was sat at the front, like, you know, where did you last see your thing? And I was harangued about how inappropriate this was, et cetera, et cetera. Now, having worked with members of the Communist Party in student politics, I have to say, it wasn't that frightening, and it was rather funny. But it was a pretty extraordinary thing, and you'd get things like...
Did you initiate that proposal, or were you invited?
No, I think there was a general invitation to people
so
to
you
make...
Could, you could do that.
And so I was told that if I ever make a proposal again, I had to take it through a curator, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And because it actually got as far as the exhibition committee, I think, or the displays committee.
And do you recall any other proposals that went from education department into the curatorial realm at all?
Not in my time. I don't think so.
Just sort of picking up again, just going back to the research and the publication, of course, in the period that you moved to Tate Modern, I think I'd be right in saying that was also the beginning of webcasting, or filming. Can you say something about the introduction of media and documentation of... Because in a way, that would have achieved something of what you were trying to...
Well, we did tape the events we did pretty well exhaustively when we were here, and then, what was her name? There's this New Zealand woman who came and did the webcasting, and she was absolutely, you know, when you meet a mind that is so bloody sharp, she was terrific. Absolutely terrific. What's her name? She was bright as a spark. I remember watching the World Cup with her, and she already had English football right off the, you know, every name, everything. So she was terrific. Anyway, she sorted the webcasting, and she did a terrific job.
So that was only at Tate Modern, was it?
It was Tate Modern. So I was able to, you know, walk up on the beginning of a conference and say, hello, everybody here, hello. And can I say for the web people watching this on the webcast, hello, New Zealand, hello, Brazil, because there would be people, sad people on computers elsewhere in the world watching this stuff going out. So that was very exciting, that we were getting a visual record and it was being webcast.
And did that impact on the type of events or the nature of the events, or was it just another...
I don't think it was formative, except that... I'm terribly bad at names, sorry. But the New Zealand lady, she curated some events which were to do with new media arts and which were very successful. She did some terrific conferences which brought anybody who knew anybody into the... I'd done one myself, which was pretty lackluster and unauthoritative. But when she got her hands on doing conferences, she did. She really brought the bacon and was cracking it. And then I did one with people at Central Saint Martin, and we repeated that. And we did some pretty high profile, I think probably quite good, and authoritative new media conferences.
Just sort of coming on to my sort of final questions. You've gone on to write a lot about the changes in institutions and institution practice and the rise of managerialism and professionalisation. Did you actually witness any of this in your time at Tate? You were here for only 10 years. You've gone on to write in terms of more contemporary. But what kind of changes, did you see any changes in the institution?
Well, I think the rise of that question that Nick asked me about how I got to learn about managing at Tate, and I think my actual reply was, well, we've all been put through the managerial mill, if you're middle management in art schools, even at academia then. So, you know, one had been on management courses when I'd been in academia. What the change was, which took place while I was at Tate, was the idea that the management discourse became the conduit through which the political agenda for art was being set. So it came in the same package. So that the modes of supervision that had been developed for financial management were now applied to cultural management. And in terms of, say, it was no longer a question that you might have got in the Thatcherite time about how many people are attending and how much money you're making. It now said who was attending. And so certain sort of groups, as we were talking about before, became consequential. So what I think was a change is that managerialism or managerial discourse became a more direct cultural weapon of the state in that period. And that was I was aware of happening here at the Tate and elsewhere. And that's what set my alarm bells ringing.
I want, is that really true? I mean, you're the first person from this era who would have described it like that, because most people have talked about the amount of flexibility and the amount of opportunity and the amount of freedom in practice.
Well, I think they, as far as I can understand it, it's this. The DCMS set certain sort of target activities and audiences to the arts institutions. The Arts Council swallowed those whole and proceeded to destroy themselves as a voice, serious voice, of culture in this country pretty well. What the Tate did was it grew appendices and informed primarily about education, where it actually did the kind of outreach and addressed the kind of audiences that DCMS applied, and kept to a very large extent the integrity of its actual core practice, which I think was a very sensible thing to do. And there's a kind of way where you should, of course, the reason why you should bother with young audiences as an institution and different social and cultural groups is because you are building your audience. It is, you should do it for selfish reasons, not because you're doing them good, but because you're actually trying to increase your punterdom, as it were. And so I'm not against. I mean, I've spent my life in education. I've taught in adult education. I'm doing WEA classes, all that sort of stuff. I'm for it. It's a very strong and important thing to do, and the institution should be doing it. What I am against is its idea that it should be moulded by a kind of certain social utility and based upon a kind of crass sociology, and that and which I've polemically described earlier on.
And finally, what would you say was your greatest contribution?
I think that's not a question I can answer. I really don't know. I might have been a complete bloody waste of space, but for me, it was a very exciting and interesting, high anxiety 10 years because of this thing of that you are putting on a first night. Every time, you never have second nights. You never have it settled. It's always new every time, which is exciting, adrenaline driving, and all that sort of thing. But it's something you can only take for a certain amount of time. I managed it for 10 years. I think changing from Tate Britain to Tate Modern reinvigorated my appetite. But I thought it was. I had a terrific time. I met a lot of interesting people. I enjoyed my colleagues, even though they didn't enjoy me that much. And I enjoyed. I learned a great deal, and I hope. So, whether I actually was a good thing or a bad thing in terms of the Tate, or whether I did a good job, I think I could point to certain things, which would be about this business of increasing audiences and increasing income, two things going parallel. About more, I think more could the Tate becoming a place where a lot more artists thought this is where you came to see things and talk about things and argue, that it became much more a friendly place for a young audience, art students as opposed to art history students. Those sort of things, I think maybe I helped, and I'd be glad to have done that. And then there were certain moments where the Jeremy Prynn gave a paper. And I was standing in the box with T.J. Clark. It was a Cezanne conference. And I asked each person who talked at this conference to talk about a particular Cezanne painting. No, it's De Kooning. the Cooling paper, and Jeremy Prin did this paper, and I remember turning to T.J. Clark, and we both saying, fuck, that was terrific. And every time I meet T.J. Clark, said to Tim Clark, he says, was it really that good? And eventually I got Prin to publish it, and it was quite a short paper, but as they say, about 5-page paper, but about 15-page of footnotes. It is a remarkable piece of bloody work. And then there's another one where we had the Archbishop, bloke who was going to be Archbishop of Canterbury, was on the panel, but there was John McEverley and John Thompson talking about James Lee Byas with Father Menniket, who put this white mass, and we had this appallingly bad video of the white mass, and they'd had a crap Christian conference in the first half, which was full of kitsch, and then we showed them this video after lunch of this strange white naked sort of ceremony, naked in the sense that all there was people dressed in white, this sort of thing, went on for about 20 minutes or more of doing the mass according to James Lee Byas. And then up got McEverley and John Thompson. They talked about James Lee Byas, and Menniket talked about, and I could see this audience full of sort of Christians and theologians being absolutely bloody flabbergasted, because what they got from McEverley and Thompson was very bright, theologically informed, both, I mean, McEverley, I'm sure, educated by Jesuits, talking about this guy and his art. And I remember McEverley saying that Byas was a falling angel, and what we saw in his work was a moment when he passed by this sort of window, and it was a terrific metaphor. It was a magical event, and two disciplines kind of enmeshed. And I think a lot of people who'd been sort of sitting there watching, looking at this Christian kitsch at the beginning of the day, walked out having actually got some sense of what the metaphysics of the avant-garde in a very serious and important way. And I think that for me was an extraordinary conference. But those are the high points for me. Well, that was one of the high points for me. Even the next Archbishop of Canterbury was flabbergasted. I could sort of came up afterwards and said, "Call blimey," rather than anything else. Yes.
On that note, I think I'll say thank you very much and open it to the floor. Are there any questions?
Andrew, I really enjoyed that. I'm really enjoying this whole week, and it is like sort of vicariously entering into the kind of life you lived here for 10 years. I suppose from where we're placed at the moment in Tate Encounters, thinking very much about kind of audience and the kind of politics of the state, there is something, whilst I can kind of assent to your, in a sense, bringing that kind of version of the critical discourse and, if anything, the kind of almost, you may not agree with this, but kind of avant-gardist but certainly libertarian kind of discourse into the museum and kind of reenacting it and fighting for the space for it to be here very successfully. I just wonder what you also then think, because you are somebody who is interested in kind of the politics of culture and popular culture historically as well. And I just, in a way, the justifiable and deserved kind of rubbishing of the New Labour kind of project doesn't do away with, the question still remains about how the museum can relate to an art school kind of culture, but there is still a bigger culture beyond that. And whilst I think, again, you rightfully reject the kind of patronising approach to widening kind of participation, it is still there. I mean, you know, if you think about what's happening in art schools now, whether art schools are still the places for the kind of, experiment that you experienced yourself as an art student, I don't know. And, of course, the number of people going into higher education has massively expanded, again, by the same politics of this government, so that now the target is for 50% of 18 to 24-year-olds to be undergraduates. But they're going to be undergraduate accountants, managers, people who are going to work in the NHS. You know, they are a big technocratic group. Now, I don't think they are coming to museums. You know, I think in a way, the sense of this cultural, critical cultural debate, or even the critical discourse about culture, from my experience of being in one of the new university sectors, is that that is not, there's no connection, you know, between the educational project of producing a kind of critique and how that might link into the museum. This is not about saying it's got to be the single mothers or whoever, but this is about saying, look, there's another wide and big group of people who are being educated, who, in Bourdieu's terms, you know, were the people who could experience culture, could engage in that kind of critical culture, but they're just somehow still not connecting. And for you, you almost, it sound as if, well, that's just not my business, as it were. Or,
well, I'm surprised because, I mean, partly, you know, when I went to St. Martin's in the early 60s, you were into a culture which you assumed nobody's going to make much money out of, which was on the margins of fashionability, which was where the number of people coming to the Tate would be relatively limited. We're now in a situation where that culture is incredibly fashionable, where it gets a massive amount of, okay, crap coverage, and the numbers of people coming to museums and art galleries has grown to, hugely. And I put this down partly, precisely, to that expansion of education. That the need for a technocracy, the need for education, has expanded the potential group for whom avant-garde art or that tradition makes sense. In a sense, you could say I would actually argue that avant-garde art comes out of the nascent technocracy. If you look at Courbet's studio, the people on the right, his fellow travellers, are all intellectuals. They are precisely that nascent class that is now massively replicated by modern the needs of modernity in terms of managerial classes and administrators and technicians and et cetera, et cetera. So I think we do appeal to that audience. Now, you could say what proportion, I don't know, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that the fact that they come and they look around. And, I mean, if you, I'd have thought for a huge number of, I mean, the Tate is a cool place for young people to go to, from what one hears, that they, you know, it's one of the things that they do. And these are probably people who are doing precisely your in higher education. The question, there are other questions there. So, I mean, I think you've raised a lot of things, how to map this, and I think I don't have adequate or very firmly based opinions, but it would seem to me there is a problem that you're pointing to, because when I went to arts, when I was teaching at Goldsmiths, the staff student ratio was something like 6 or 7 to 1. I think now it's more like 20 to 1. There are people like Alison Wolfe who have argued that the idea that higher education is of great benefit to people is one that was predicated on precisely that kind of high quality, intense relationship between students and academics, which is now mass education has destroyed. So it's no longer become an intrinsic good in which people's actual intellectual and cultural abilities are achieved. It's become only a situational good. That is to say, it's rather like if you're going for an interview for a bank, you should have a suit. If you haven't got one, you won't get the job. Well, in a sense, you won't get a job now if you don't have a degree. The quality of the degree has ceased to matter. It's a situational good, not an intrinsic good. And so I think, you know, we have a real problem with the idea of mass education, which needs looking at, because certainly from my experience from doing a bit of teaching in art schools since I left the Tate and whatever, they are not... And talking to people like John Thompson and people like that. I mean, art schools are not what they were, and not what they were in ways which I think are deeply problematic. And so I think there is a real issue here about the character of the education that people are getting. And partly, it is the idea that sort of criticality has become a sort of form of etiquette. So you're obliged to speak if you assume a sort of constructivist view of language and culture. And that's what's meant by criticality. So it's, once again, you pressed a button which once I started I could bore for England on. But I think I was addressing that broader educated, people being educated. And I'd have said that the number of younger people coming in my time increased, and I think in a way the avant-garde addresses their issues, because as I say, they come from the same sociological strata. The artists come from the same sociological strata as the people you're describing in universities, and it is their art and their culture which we are promulgating and propagating. But I'd then go on to say there are other versions of art and other forms of life and aesthetics which we're not promulgating.
I'll just add to that. I was very glad, Andrew, that you pointed out, which is important to point out, relative to the Bourdieu issue, that the bourgeoisie in Britain evolved very differently. But in that regard, I would suggest that there was, in the 19th century, that shotgun marriage of the publicly funded art school, government, and museums, and the separation of that conjunction of forces means that each item in that triad, the museum, the art school, and the government, have each repressed that union in various ways. And when, as you have done, you, in a way, you brought that art school discourse back to the museum, you did it with, as it were, the art school set of repressions clashing with the museum set, and so forth and so on. So I think that's one reason why it was so interesting.
I think the history of, you know, art schools being created to improve the arts of manufacture and all that sort of thing is interesting, but it's always interesting to remember that art schools were never supposed to be places where you did fine art. They were places to teach teachers if they did art practice, image making at all, except for, you know. So in other words, fine art was something that grew in the art school structure against the prescriptions which actually set them up. I always think that somebody in the Ministry of Education, who's about 150 years old, who was saying, I'll get the buggers in the end. You know, because we grew these things, and then eventually, I mean, when I went to St. Martin's, I did intermediate examination in arts and crafts, and the idea that art education was still a craft discipline, in principle, I could have been doing that examination with people who had been taught wallpapering or house painting. St. Martin's had pushed all that stuff out of it, but if you'd done it in other art schools, you would actually have sat down and done some common examination with people who had been taught that kind of thing. What Coldstream did was actually reinvent the art student, or acknowledge the art student as an intellectual, as, in a sense, some sort of, having some sort of family resemblance to university student. And that was a sort of a culmination of a process of a misuse of art schools by the ideology of art that had been going on since the art schools got mucked up first off by being flooded through genteel women who insisted on doing drawing and painting in the mid-19th century. So, you know, it is always good to remember. It's a great joy to remember that the state prescribes and then people do other things with it.
I just want to ask one question, just listening to you and thinking about it. As I said earlier, living through something, you did take, I would say, one of the most explicit political positions I've ever known a member of staff take in the museum, or even heard of it. I mean, you articulated politics de rigueur from start to finish. The museum, by the history in it and its own account, has always presented itself as impartial, neutral, on behalf of the nation, a bigger, wider than a political construct. Were you trying to bring were you trying to politicise the museum as a construct, as or was it just your personal politics in terms of an institutional critique?
I mean, the first article I published was called Art and the State, Tate Gallery and Art and the State, or something like that, in 1977, and it was arguing that we should understand the Tate in relationship to Gramsci's theory of the intellectuals. And so in a way, it was, I mean, it's habitual for me to assume that it was in some sense political. Now, in what sense political? Because I would be anxious to say that not everything is political. If you say everything's political, then you're saying it becomes meaningless. I suppose, actually, it's almost saying it's not political. It's going down to the Wittgenstein's argument that any aesthetic judgment is to be understood in terms of a form of life. And I suppose at that time, the most radical form of description of life I had was by class. But then what Gramsci introduced was the idea of a strata intellectuals who were not reducible to a class, although in his account, I mean, for him, they were different. They became aligned with different classes, but he always saw them a subaltern group, and where others argue that they weren't. And part of going back to your argument about the training of the technocracy, that to what degree have intellectuals, meaning people who earn their money from their cultural capital, are a class or not? I think is a question you can argue about, and maybe it falls down ultimately in the inadequacy of the notion of class. And being a Weberian nowadays rather than a Marxist, I would not want to entertain a single category of classification. For me, it had always been, in that sense, political, or maybe a better way of putting it, sociological. That is to say, I never believed that it was a institution that had a universal audience. Museums and galleries are run by, show work by, and are attended by the educated. And every bloody sociological survey or audience survey will tell you that over and over again. Now, to a lot of people, that's to regret. We should be reaching out to, and I no more worry about that than I'd worry that the number of academic art historians of either gender in boxing matches is rather small. In a sense, if you have a culture produced out of the anxieties and desires and fantasies of being an intellectual, why should, if I'm a bricklayer, should I be interested in that? I mean, there are other things I'm interested in. I have a different culture, and it's not part of the museum's job to go and tell the bricklayer that he should have another culture. What the question then becomes, particularly if you're going to say this strata of society, the intellectuals in the broadest sense, are now a ruling class or incredibly important as a powerful group, is to actually introduce into their culture a criticality which reflects upon their own condition, that puts into question the character of their class. And so, for example, raising the issue, I mean, the supposedly unquestionable goodness of education. I mean, education is our major form of social stratification now. And the idea that actually going through these educational rituals in order to achieve your social position, this is beyond question. Well, I'd have thought all those, our own assumptions, values and ideas, are up for question. And art is one of the ways that one does it, because partly it's the anomalous business of people who speak through images and not through words in a culture which is ruled by the discursive, gives art a natural, maybe not the right word, but a potential difference which may itself be a kind of criticality, can be a criticality.
Andrew, what about the brickies' taxes that go to support the institution? Why should he pay them?
I think it's a very good question. Sorry, if you ask an old man to sit on a platform, he's going to reminisce. I remember once having a meeting with Alan Bowness, and he invited me and some various other people here. And Alan Yentob came to this meeting. At that meeting, I said, on the sort of argument that I made today, I said, look, the people who attend museums and art galleries are the educated. Why the hell should brickies pay out of general taxation for those? We should charge for museum entry. And I remember Alan Yentob walking out, I think he's walking out anyway, followed by his minions. And I was spitting at me virtually in rage, because the idea that I think there are arguments for saying I think I would argue that it is a general public good, and I think there is a justification for supporting that general taxation. But I do think that you should seek to have a proportion, that there's nothing wrong with people paying to go into museums and art galleries. It's not a self-evident wrong, should I put it that way. I like the idea that our galleries are free, and I think it is a public good, and I would wish it to continue. Also, there's a good argument that you can say that actually you can extract far more money out of people buying books and cups of coffee than you would if you charge them to come through the door, and you don't have to administrate it. So I think it's a question that's worth asking, and it's. And the idea that you have to, you know, that it's deeply immoral makes, you know, you have to pay to go to Dutch museums and art galleries. But I would want it to be free on the basis that it just does mean more people can come in just casually rather than having to make it a trip.
And just to persist with this, you mentioned talking about the Brickies, your national Brickies culture. What is the distance from the pin-up on the building site, shed wall? What is the distance from the Brickies pin-up to a Lucian Freud nude here, for example, or any other, for that matter, Velázquez, if you like, in the National Gallery?
You could say, you'd have to ask the question, why did they stick up that pin-up rather than another one? What's the discrimination that goes on? And that's the thing. And that's probably a very complex aesthetic and a culture. It's not one that I have had a training in. But that it is a culture is a thing that you have to recognise. That there is forms of discrimination going on and maybe arguments. Because, you know, you might have one of the Brickies is a Catholic and he objects to that being up there and objects to it on moral grounds. So it's not necessarily an empty, you're assuming, you know, all Brickies like looking at ladies out of page 3 or something, but it's not necessarily like that.
I think the point I was making is that there is a continuum, not an actual cutoff between, I don't know, page 3 of The Sun or a penthouse centre spread or whatever, and a Lucian Freud nude, or even a Velázquez nude, or a Titian nude. I mean, they're not two different categories of things. They're different
categories of attention. But like, there's a difference between football and rugby. There are different rules of a sense of games of attention going on, I think.
Anyway, we could go on all night.
No.
A second go. While you've been talking, I've been thinking a bit more about my questions. I mean, the thing about Gramsci, for me, was that there was for him always a kind of purpose in trying to define the role of the intellectual in relationship to the Brickie. That one thing. There was always other bigger purposes and reasons for being an intellectual, and that always did tie back down to labour for him. And the other thing that Gramsci was very interested in was how the intellectual engaged in the process of change. And if you think about, whilst I think probably if I were you, I'd have done the same as you in a way. I just wonder, like, I've listened to you for an hour and a half saying you would not change. You know, there are things, you know, when you try to engage with changing the institution, you know, 20 minutes you needed the fag because, you know, or you rejected managerialism. And then equally, you know, the Brickie you valued and as, here the metaphor of the Brickie, as somebody who didn't need to come to the museum. Now, I can occupy that, but it seems to me both of those, from kind of Gramsci's point of view, didn't connect the work of the intellectual to the kind of social body. You seem to have, other than, you know, bringing the art school, the kind of radical discourse of the art school, into the adult talks program.
You know, I think that's right. I think maybe I would never do this thing that. Sorry about this. The guy at Wimbledon, audio arts, Bill Dutt, which he calls his interview activity art, because I would never art practice. But there's a kind of way that if you are trained as an artist, there are certain. It doesn't necessarily follow this, but there is a kind of idea, and let's put it in a grand way. There's an ethics of practice. That is to say, you take the practice and you practice it as seriously as you can, and basically that means that you push away other ethical demands. And I think, to a certain extent, that was both the what might have been valuable about what I did, but also about its limitations. That is to say, I wanted to run a vivacious, serious program, and that was the priority. So even the magazine idea was to feed that. And so the integrity of the program was what was the formative aim. Now, I actually would defend that politically, in as much that I think there's a kind of way in which, if you assume that there's a coherent moral overview into which you can fit yourself, I have yet to encounter that coherent moral, political, social overview. I mean, Gramsci's view was based upon the idea of the proletariat as a class in the process of becoming. Well, give us wrong. Also, don't forget, he also called for a totalitarian state and this sort of thing. So there's a kind of way in which I think. When you walk into a doctor's, and this is another thing this government corrupts, is that when you walk into a doctor, you want him to or her to tell you what's wrong. They want him or her or you to give their best advice about what should be done, and what you don't want them to do is to be arsing around with government targets and corrupting that relationship, that medical relationship, by extraneous, bureaucratic, political, moral, whatever, belief. So that if they disapprove of you, I don't want to know whether the doctor approves me or not. None of his damn or her business. What I want to know is what their serious, the integrity of their own view of my particular condition. And so it's that would be a defence, I suppose, of what you might call a blinkered practice. And I think there are defences to make of it, but I'm not putting it forward an absolute, because I do think in certain sort of practices, certain sort of positions, you have to take on a broader strategic view. But what I suppose I am contesting is the idea that the broader view necessarily applies to the ethical assumptions, which you can then decide the micro activity.
We're just coming to wind up on the hour, but I suppose the thoughts I'm left with is understanding why you most probably didn't get the ship at the beginning, but also then wondering how you were left to operate or why you were left to operate in the way you did for so long. And I can't tell whether that's because nobody from the institution ever came to what you did, so didn't know what you were doing, or whether when they did know, was a reason in that free license.
I had sympathetic bosses. I know that Richard Humphreys kept Jeremy Lewis and off at certain times, and I think Nick was supportive, and I think partly Nick was supportive because he would go to grand events somewhere in the world and somebody would come and say, oh, I had a wonderful time giving a paper at Tate Modern, and then there would be people that they would start looking at in terms of purchase because they thought their work, and they'd noticed that they'd had given a talk at the Tate before they were even considered for purchase, things like that. So in a way, I suppose one of the things was that having my audience was the same audience as the Tate, as it were, the same social, same hierarchy, status game as the whole institution, rather than actually wanting to win status within the Tate itself. And I think as long as I was putting bums on seats, getting good vibrations, people were very happy to go with it. And I think to a certain extent they were actually agreed with a lot of the arguments I'm making, and some people who might agree more than they can possibly say in public.
And I think on that note, we'll end. Thank you very much, Andrew.